One of the large advert boards on the side of the van swung open suddenly on squealing brass hinges. A carriage door, it seemed, for a small, stout, balding man hopped through it from within the van. He wore a neat red shooting coat and checkered trousers tucked into patent leather walking boots. He was bareheaded, his round, red-cheeked face was not masked, and to Mallory's astonishment he was smoking a large, vilely fuming pipe.
"What's all this, then?" he inquired mildly. "A ruffian, sir," the coachman declared. "Some villain bully rock sent by turkey-legs." "What, all by hisself?" the stout man said, with a quizzical arch of his brows. "That don't seem right." He looked Mallory up and down. "You know who I am, son?"
"No," Mallory said. "Who are you?"
"I'm the gent they call the King of the Bill-Stickers, my boy. If you don't know that fact, you must be mighty green at this business."
"I'm not in your business. I, sir, am Dr. Edward Mallory."
The stout man folded his arms and rocked a bit on his boot heels.
"So? You just pasted up a bill that grossly libelled me."
"Oh," said the King, "so that's your bellyache, is it?"
He grinned in evident relief.
"Well, that's nothing to do with me, Dr. Edward Mallory. I just paste 'em. I don't print 'em. I ain't liable."
"Well, you're not putting up any more of those damnable libel sheets," Mallory said. "I want all the rest of them, and I demand to know where you obtained them."
The King quieted his two bristling henchmen with a regal move of his hand.
"I'm a very busy man, Dr. Mallory. If you care to step up in my van and talk to me like a reasonable gentleman, then perhaps I'll listen. But I've no time for any bluster or threats."
He fixed Mallory with a sharp squint of his little blue eyes.
"Well," Mallory blurted, taken aback.
Though he knew he was in the right, the King's quiet retort had taken the steam out of his indignation. He felt rather foolish of a sudden, and rather out of his element, somehow.
"Surely," he muttered. "Very well. Fair enough. Tom, Jimmy, let's get back to work."
The King clambered deftly into his van. Mallory, after a moment's hesitation, followed him, heaving himself up into the body of the oddly made carriage. There were no seats inside. The flooring from wall to wall was dimpled and buttoned with thick maroon cushioning, like a Turkish ottoman. Slanted pigeonholes of varnished wood lined the walls, stuffed with tightly rolled bills. A large trap-door in the ceiling had been flung open, admitting a gloomy light. It stank direly of paste and cheap black shag tobacco. The King sprawled at his ease, propping himself on a fat, tufted pillow. The mule brayed under the driver's whip crack, and the van lurched into sluggish, squeaking motion.
"Gin and water?" the King offered, opening a cabinet.
"Plain water, if you please," Mallory said.
"Straight water it is,"
the King poured from a pottery canteen into a tin mug. Mallory tugged his frayed mask down below his chin and drank, with an aching thirst. The King gave Mallory a second round, and then a third.
"Perhaps a tasty squeeze of lemon with that?"
the King winked.
"I do hope you know your limit."
Mallory cleared his slimy throat.
"Very decent of you."
His face felt oddly naked without the mask, and this show of civility within the King's van, together with its chemical stink of glue, almost worse than the Thames, had quite dizzied him.
"I regret it if I seemed a bit sharp earlier." "Well, it's the lads, you know," said the King, with generous tact. "A cove must stand ready to handle his fists in the bill-sticking business. Just yesterday my boys had to lay on pretty brisk with old Turkey-legs and his lads over a matter of sticking space within Trafalgar Square."
The King sniffed in disdain.
"I've had certain sharp troubles of my own during this emergency," Mallory said hoarsely. "But basically, I'm a reasonable man, sir. Very rational, not the sort who looks for trouble, you mustn't think that."
The King nodded sagely.
"I've never yet known Turkey-legs to hire any scholar as a bully rock. By your dress and manner I take you to be a savant, sir." "You have a sharp eye."
"I like to think so," the King allowed.
"So now that we have that matter clear, perhaps you'll informate me concerning this grievance you seem to hold."
"Those bills you've pasted are forgeries," Mallory said, "and libelous. They're certainly not legal."
"As I explained before, that's none of my affair," the King said. "Let me tell you a few facts of commerce, straight out. For dabbing up 100 double-crown sheets, I expect to make £1.1, which is to say tuppence and six-tenths of a penny per sheet. Say threepence, rounded out. Now, if you should care to purchase certain of my bills at that rate, I might be ready to talk business."
"Where are they?" Mallory said.
"If you care to have a look among the cubby-holes for the items in question, I will oblige you."
When the crew had stopped to paste more bills, Mallory began to sort through the stock. The bills were tightly wrapped in neat, thick, perforated scrolls as dense and hefty as bludgeons. The king passed a scroll through the trap door to the driver. Then he peaceably tapped out the dottle of his meerschaum, refilled it from a twist of coarse paper, and lit it with a German tinderbox. He blew a cloud of foulness with every appearance of satisfaction.
"Here they are,"
Mallory said. He peeled the outermost sheet from the roll and flapped it out within the van.
"Have a look at this abomination, will you? It looks quite splendid at first, but the text is obscenely outrageous.
Standard roll of 40, that'll be 6 shillings even.
Read here," Mallory said, "where it as much as accuses me of murder."
The king, politely, turned his eyes upon the sheet. His lips moved as he puzzled painfully over the title.
"My Laurie," he said at length. "One of your Laurie shows, is it?"
"Mallory, that's my name."
"It's a demi-sheet theatrical, no illos," the king said, a bit smudgy.
"Oh, yes, I remember these."
He sighed smoke. "I might have known no good would come of taking this consignment.
Mind you, the rascal paid in advance, though."
"Who?
Whom?"
"Down in Limehouse, in the West India docks," the king said. "A deal of commotion in that locale, Dr. Mallory. Rascals slapping brand-new bills up all over every wall and hoarding in sight since yesterday. My boys were inclined to make a bit of trouble over that encroachment till Captain Swing, that's what he calls himself, saw fit to engage our services."
Mallory's armpits prickled with sweat.
"Captain Swing, is it?"
"Sporting fellow of some kind, to judge by his dress," the king said cheerfully. "Short, red-headed, squinty. Had a bump on his head, just here. Crazy as a bedbug, I should say. He was polite enough, though, not proposing to make any trouble for the bill-sticking trade once customary matters was explained to him. And he had him a sight of ready money."
"I know that man,"
Mallory said, his voice trembling.
"He's a violent Luddite conspirator. He may be the most dangerous man in England."
"You don't say," the king grunted.
"He's a dire threat to public safety."
"Fellow didn't look like much," the king said. "Funny little duck, wore spectacles and talked to herself.
The man is an enemy of the realm, a dark lanternist of the most sinister description."
"I don't much hold with politics myself," said the king, leaning back quite at his ease. "The Bill-Sticking Regulatory Act, now that's politics for you, a doltish business. That blasted act is mighty stiff regarding where bills may be posted. Let me tell you, Dr. Mallory, I personally know the member that got that act passed in Parliament, for I was hard for his election campaign. He didn't mind where his bills went. It was all quite right enough, so long as they was his bills."
"My God," Mallory broke in, "the thought of that evil man, loose in London, with money from God only knows what source, fomenting riot and rebellion during a public emergency, and in control of an engine-driven press. It's nightmarish, horrible."
"Pray don't fash yourself, Dr. Mallory," the king chided gently. "My dear old father, rest his soul, used to tell me, when all about you are losing their heads, son, just remember, there are still 20 shillings in a pound."
"That's as may be," Mallory said. "But my dear dad stuck bills in the time of troubles, back in the '30s, when the cavalry charged on the working people, and old hooky-nosed Wellington got hisself blown to flinders. Hard times indeed, sir. Much harder than soft modern days with this trifling stink. Call this an emergency? Why, I call it opportunity, and have done with it."
"You don't seem to grasp the urgency of the crisis," Mallory said.
"The time of troubles. Now that was when they printed the first 4-sheet double crowns. The Tory government used to pay my old dad—my dad was beadle and bill-sticker to the parish of St. Andrew's, Holborn—to blackwash radical bills. You had to hire women to do it. There was so much call for the job. He'd blackwash rad bills by day and stick up new ones by night. There's a deal of fine opportunity in your times of revolution."
Mallory sighed.
"My dad invented the device he called the patent extendable dabbing joint, to which I myself have made a number of mechanical improvements. It serves to stick bills to the undersides of bridges for the water trade. We are an entrepreneurial line in my family, sir, not easily put out of countenance."
"A lot of good all that will do you when London's reduced to ashes," Mallory said.
"Why, you're helping the scoundrel in his anarchistic plottings."
"I should say you have that straight backwards, Dr. Mallory," the king said, with an odd little chuckle. "Last I saw, the fellow was paying his money into my pockets, and not vice versa. Now that I think on it, he's consigned a number of bills to my safekeeping. Right along the top row here."
The king stood, yanked the documents down, cast them onto his padded floor.
"You see, sir, it don't really matter a hang what nonsense is blithered and babbled on these bills. The secret truth is that bills is endless by their very nature, regular as the tides in the Thames or the smoke of London. London's true sons call London the smoke, you know. She's an eternal city, like your Jerusalem, or Rome, or, some would say, Satan's pandemonium. You don't see the King of the Bill Stickers worrying for smoky London, do you? Not a bit of it. But the people have fled.
A passing foolishness. They'll all be back, said the King, with sublime confidence.
Why, they have no place else to go. This is the centre of the world, sir.
Mallory fell silent.
So, sir, proclaimed the King, if you was to take my advice, you'd spend 6 shillings on that roll of bills you're clutching. Why, for £1 even, I'll toss in these other misprinted bills of our friend Captain Swings. 20 simple shillings, sir, and you may leave these streets and rest at home in peace and quiet.
Some of these bills have already been posted, Mallory said.
I could have the lads blackwash 'em, or paste 'em over anyhow, the King mused. If you was willing to make it worth their while, of course.
Would that put an end to the matter? Said Mallory, reaching for his pocket-book.
I doubt it. A better end than any you can make with that pistol I see peeping from your trouser-band, said the King. That is an item which cannot do a gentleman and scholar any credit.
Mallory said nothing.
Heed my counsel, Dr. Mallory, and put that gun away before you do yourself a mischief. I do believe you might have hurt one of my lads if I hadn't spied that gun through my peephole and stepped out to set things right. Go home, sir, and cool your head.
Why aren't you at home, if you truly mean that advice?
Mallory said.
Why, this is my home, sir, said the King.
He tucked Mallory's money into his shooting jacket.
On pleasant days my old woman and I take our tea in here and talk about old times, and walls, and embankments, and hoardings.
I have no home in London, and in any case business calls me to Kensington, Mallory said.
That's a distance, Dr. Mallory.
Yes, it is,
Mallory said with a tug at his beard.
But it strikes me that there are any number of museums and savants' palaces in Kensington which have never been touched by advert paper.
Really? Mused the King. Do tell.
Mallory bade the King farewell a good mile from the Palace of Paleontology. He was unable to bear the fumes of glue any longer, and the van's lurching had made him badly seasick. He staggered off with the heavy scrolls of libelous and anarchic bills bundled awkwardly in his sweating grip. Behind him, Jemmy and Tom set to eager glue-slapping on the virgin bricks of the Palace of Political Economy. Mallory propped the rolled bills against an ornate lamp-post and re-knotted his cloth mask over nose and mouth. His head spun evilly. Perhaps he thought that sticking paste had had a bit of arsenic in it, or the ink some potent, nauseous, coal derivative, for he felt poisoned and weak in his very marrow. When he juggled up the bills again, their paper wrinkled in his sweating hands like the peeling skin of a drowned man. He had, it seemed, frustrated a lashing bite of the tout's hydra-headed devilment. But this minor triumph seemed wretchedly small when matched against the villain's seemingly endless reservoirs of wicked ingenuity. Mallory was stumbling in darkness, while torn at will by invisible fangs. And yet Mallory had discovered a crucial piece of evidence. The tout was gone to earth in the West India docks. To be so close to a chance to grapple with the scoundrel, and yet so far. It was enough to madden a man. Mallory stumbled badly on a slick lump of horse dung, then swung the scrolls up onto his right shoulder in an unstable heap. It was a useless fantasy to imagine confronting the tout, alone, unaided, while the man was miles away back across the chaos of London. Mallory had almost reached the palace now, and it had taken well-nigh all he had to manage the trick of it. He forced himself to concentrate on the matters at hand. He would haul the wretched bills to the palace safety box. They might prove useful as evidence some day, and they could take the place of Madeline's wedding clock. He would take up the clock, he would find a way to flee this cursed London, and he would rejoin his family as he should have done. In green Sussex, in the bosom of the good old Clawney, there would be quiet and sense and safety. The gears of his life would begin to mesh once more in order. Mallory lost his grip on the rolls of paper, and they cascaded violently to the tarmac, one of them hitting him a smart blow across the shins as it bounded free. He gathered them up, groaning, and tried the other shoulder. In the rancid mists down Knightsbridge, a procession of some kind was moving steadily across the road. Ghost-like, blurred by distance and the stink, they appeared to be military gurneys, the squat, treaded monsters of the Crimean War. Fog muffled a heavy chugging and faint repeated clank of jointed iron. One after another they passed, while Mallory peered forward, standing quite still and gripping his burden. Each gurney hauled a linked, articulated caisson. These wains appeared to be canvas-shrouded cannon, with men, foot soldiers in canvas-coloured drab, clustered atop the cannons like barnacles, with a sea-urchin bristle of bayoneted rifles. At least a dozen war gurneys, possible a score. Mallory rubbed his aching eyes in puzzled disbelief. At Brompton Concourse he saw a trio of masked and hatted figures scamper off with light foot tread from a broken doorway, but no one offered trouble to him. Some civil authority had erected sawhorses at the gate of the Palace of Paleontology, but the barricades were not manned. It was a simple matter to slip past them and up the fog-slick stone stairs to the main entrance. The palace's great double doors were thickly curtained in a protective shroud of wet canvas, hung from the brick archway down to the very flagstones. The thick, damp fabric smelled sharply of chloride of lime. Behind the canvas, the palace doors were slightly ajar. Mallory eased his way inside. Servants were draping the furniture of lobby and drawing room with thin white sheets of muslin. Others, a peculiar crowd of them, swept and mopped, and dabbled earnestly at the cornices with long jointed feather dusters. London women, and a large number of children of all ages, bustled about wearing borrowed palace cleaning aprons, looking anxious but vaguely exalted. Mallory realized at length that these strangers must be the families of the palace staff, come to seek shelter and security within the grandest public building known to them. And someone, Kelly, the major domo, presumably, with help from whatever savants still remained on the premises, had pluckily organized the refugees. Mallory strode toward the lobby desk, lugging his paper burden. These were sturdy, working-class folk, he realized. Their stations might be humble, but they were Britons through and through. They were not daunted. They had rallied in instinctive defense of their scientific institutions and the civil values of law and property. He realized, with a heart-lifting wash of patriotic relief, that the lurching madness of chaos had reached its limit. Within the faltering maelstrom, a nucleation of spontaneous order had arisen. Now, like a cloudy muck resolving into crystals, everything would change. Mallory flung his hated burden behind the deserted counter of the lobby desk. In one corner, a telegraph was clacking fitfully, new punch tape spooling by fits and starts upon the floor. Mallory observed this small but significant miracle and sighed, like a diver whose head has broken water. The palace air was sharp with disinfectant, but blissfully breathable. Mallory stripped the filthy mask from his face and stuffed it in his pocket. Somewhere in this blessed shelter, he thought, there was food to be had. Perhaps a wash basin and soap, and sulfurated powder for the fleas that had been creeping about his waistband since morning. Eggs, ham, restorative wine, postage stamps, laundresses, shoe blacking, the whole miraculous concatenated network of civilization. A stranger came marching toward Mallory across the lobby floor, a British soldier, an artillery subaltern in elegant dress gear. He wore a double-breasted blue coatee, bright with chevrons, brass buttons, and gold-braided epaulettes. His sleek trousers had a red military stripe. He wore a round, gold-laced forage cap and a buttoned pistol holster at his neat white waist belt. With his shoulders square, spine straight and head high, this handsome young man approached with a stern look of purpose. Mallory straightened quickly, taken aback, even vaguely shamed to compare his rumpled, sweat-stained civilian garb to this crisp military paragon. Then, with a leap of surprise, happy recognition dawned.
"Brian!" Mallory shouted. "Brian, boy!"
The soldier quickened his pace.
"Ned! Why, it is you, ain't it?"
said Mallory's brother, a tender smile parting his new Crimean beard. He seized Mallory's hand in both his own and shook it heartily with a solid strength. Mallory noted with surprise and pleasure that military discipline and scientific diet had put inches and pounds on the lad. Brian Mallory, the family's sixth-born child, had often seemed a bit quiet and timid, but now Mallory's little brother stood a good 6'4" in his military boots and had the look in his creased blue eyes of a man who had seen the world.
"We've been a-waiting for you, Ned," Brian told him.
His bold voice had slipped a bit, by some old habit, into the remembered tone of their childhood. For Mallory it was a plaintive echo from deep memory, the demands of a crowd of little children upon their eldest brother. Somehow this familiar call, far from tiring or burdening Mallory, rallied him immediately into a mental second wind. Confusion vanished like a mist, and he felt stronger, more capable. The very presence of young Brian had recalled him to himself.
"Damn me, but it's good to see you," Mallory blurted.
"It's good you're back at last," Brian said. "We heard tale of a fire in your room, and you vanished into London, none knew where. That put me and Tom in a very mizmaze."
"Tom is here too, eh?"
"We both come into London in Tom's little gurney," Brian told him.
His face fell.
"With dire news, Ned, and no ways to tell it save to your face."
"What is it?" Mallory said, bracing himself. Is it Dad?"
"No, Ned. Dad's all right, or right as he ever is these days. It is poor Madeline."
Mallory groaned.
"Not the bride-to-be. What is it now?"
"Well, it's to do with my mate, Jerry Rawlings,"
Brian muttered, squaring his epauletted shoulders with a look of embarrassed pain.
"Jerry wanted to do right by our Madeline, Ned, for he always talked of her and lived very clean for her sake. But he received such a letter at home, Ned, such a foul and dreadful thing, it quite knocked the heart out of him."
"What letter, for God's sake?"
"Well, it weren't signed, except One Who Knows. But the writer knew so much about us, the family, I mean, all our littlest doings, and said that Madeline had been unchaste, except in rougher words."
Mallory felt a surge of hot fury rush to his face.
"I understand," he said in a quiet, choked voice. "Go on."
"Well, their engagement is broken, as you might guess. Poor Maddie has the vapours like she's never had them before. She liked to do herself an injury and does nothing now but sit alone in the kitchen and cry rivers.